Billy, and I have to have a little bit of background on this. I grew up in a very strict, orthodox, conservative, traditional, I guess that's enough, Judaism here, Norwegian Lutheran background. My hometown of Kenyon, Minnesota, where there are 8 Norwegian Lutheran churches within 10 miles. And quite interesting, just a coincidence, the mother church there is Holden Lutheran Church, and that's named not for the scientist who found this place in the copper, but this is named for a place in Norway. The original pioneers came to southeast Minnesota in 1854, my great-grandfather among them, and by 1859 they founded Holden Lutheran Church. And if you're there, you know, by all means see it. It's sort of the mother church for southeastern Minnesota. And if you're a Swedish persuasion, just 20 miles away is Vesa Lutheran and Norelius. And one of the great churches, they're beautiful old churches. I like old churches. And these have been marvelously restored and lovingly kept. And you can do both Holden and Vesa easily, you know, within a space of like about 2 hours.
We have a Holden Lutheran Church in our neighborhood too in Wisconsin.
And really, yep. For goodness sake, because it has to be named for the people back there, because it's not. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you get the idea. Why do I say that? Because when I talk about some of these ideas, some people have gotten the idea, until I mentioned this, that I don't have my Norwegian Lutheran roots, you know, in order, or my traditions understood. I understand this tradition very, very well, although I didn't go quite as far as some people in our neighborhood. We even had 2 Hauge churches within 10 miles. And so if you, those of you who don't know Hauge, what that means, you know, that's not important. But if those of you who know, that's very important, right? We got some Hauges up there.
Is that predestination?
Predestination, oh, they're still arguing that one. And Preuss and Oss on that one, and no, Preuss and, yeah, Hermann Preuss and George Oss are still arguing, I think, up in heaven, where we're going to talk about if I ever get to the majority, I think they're still arguing predestination on this. I always know I like to date one girl, Patty Deardall in Kenyon. But she said, Erling, I'd like to date you, but you're just not Hauge Lutheran, so you're not going to heaven. Okay, I got the message. I don't have to make it any clearer than that. She married Donnie Bryan, who's a nice Hauge boy, and they had 6 children, and keeping the church going. But anyway, I know my Norwegian. I have to tell one more on this since you're laughing. All right. I do a lot of, as I say, adult forums, especially down, you know, Mesa, Tempe, Phoenix, Scottsdale, and all these things. And this was in Mesa, where there are lots and lots of Norwegian Lutherans. So they seem to think that's about the launching pad for heaven, I think, after Hackensack or Elbow Lake or Dawson or Starbuck or something else like that. All right. Anyway, I was doing some stuff on New Age theology and way out stuff. I mean, it's really strange, weird stuff. Reincarnation and channeling and crystal healing and all these things. And there was one older woman in the back, and I was doing some of the stuff, and they hadn't sort of introduced me much before, and I hadn't introduced myself much before, and she whispered to somebody, and then during question period it came up, are you then the Yorsta boy from Kenyon? And I said, yeah, I'm the Yorsta boy from Kenyon then. And that, then it was okay what I said. If I hadn't been the Yorsta boy from Kenyon, it might not have been okay. But since she knew I had my background in order, I could recite the Lutheran catechism faster than anybody else in my class. I didn't dare not. If you know my dad, he wanted us to know the catechism cold. All right, anyway, speaking of Kenyon, I grew up when Reverend Carl Starmo, I remember, used to give once a year, sometimes even more, he'd give a classic sermon on heaven. And it was marvelous in its sort of its poetic imagery and its aspirations, and the idea being that this was what we could look forward to, you know, when we were on the other side. And I grew up for thinking, you know, that this was basically the way heaven really would, what heaven really was all about, how it would look. Some people said what the furniture was and what the temperature was. They were more concerned. More people were more worried about what the temperature was in the other place, you know, downstairs, than they were in what the temperature was upstairs. But then I went on to college. I went to St. Olaf myself and graduated in 1952, and And at that time, just to, by way of how things change, I think I mentioned this in another class this week, we had four classes. Our Luther, you were about the same time, 54, and I was 52. Right? We had Bible, we had church history, we had doctrine, and we had ethics. And I think those were the four courses, probably when you were there too. We had HB and Hookenbeck and Ditt and Ansgar, and that basically was it. And Harland, of course, with ethics, okay. Now there's an enormous variety of courses that we have, and they show no signs of not slowing down. And I think that's all to the good. I think that's all really to the good. You heard me the other night talking about global Christianity and getting involved overseas and things like that. Okay. But what's happened, obviously, is that over the years we have come to try to understand, in light of new insights, new research, new teachings, simply the direction, the way the world is going, whether or not some of these older, more traditional interpretations, you know, of heaven and hell really are what we would call loyal to the scriptures. I'm not going to go into what I did the other night about, you know, what we can learn from other world religions. And I want to talk today is basically just about the Christian faith. But basically, I want to talk about that. And I have here a poll, which I want to, I've got four copies, and I want to give these, I suppose I should be, no, I guess they can pick this up. I'm sorry, the machine wasn't awake yet this morning. let's hand one here. And these are statistics, and then hand these back at the end. Just these, circulate these around. These are statistics on what people think, you know, about the Bible, and about what the Bible says about heaven and hell. There are lots of polls. Gallup has polls. Harris has polls. I'm going to use some polls on this. But I want to start by talking about what people have come to conclude over the years about what heaven and hell we really are. I think these are some very revealing kind of statistics, and they give us a clear picture here of the wide diversity that we have over this particular subject. Certainly there's no kind of consensus on this at all, and I think some of these statistics, if you want to look those through and pass those on, take the whole hour for this if you like, will give us some indication of this. Okay, 1996, let's have some up-to-date things. This is a Lou Harris poll. He asked the question about what are you the most worried in this life? What worries you the most in this life? The most frequently named answers to what worries you the most in this life were, first of all, losing one's job, or losing one's pension, or not having enough health insurance, being victim of a crime. Only 8% said they worried about hell. That would indicate something of a change that's taken place, because always the idea before was hell was such, you know, a frightening place, one way in which you could frighten people into, so to speak, move in the other direction and start thinking about heaven would be to point to portray, you know, the fears and doubts and all those things about hell. Only 8% said they worried a lot about hell. 70, another in that same poll said they were not worried one bit, about going to hell at all. 76% said they were not worried a bit on this. In the Barna poll in 1997, 62% said that Satan is not a living being. 62% said that Satan is not a living being, but a symbol of evil on this. Did hell exist as a specific actual location, a place of physical torment? 31% said yes. 31% of that. Contrast that to what, you know, we had thought before, and if you know the paintings, and of course the portrayals that we have here. And I must say myself, one of the things that's got me started on this was that I was fortunate enough at St. Olaf for maybe the last 10 years to teach in what we call the Great Books, and we taught Dante's Divine Comedy. And we spent a great deal of time on the Inferno. And it's the most powerful piece of literature I think I've ever, other than the Bible, I've ever read in my life. It just absolutely blew me away. And not only were the literary things, but then the paintings that went along with this. If you want to have something that's a powerful thing, and yet is a very strong affirmation, Dante's Divine Comedy. It took him 29 years to write. And I'm surprised he did it in such a short time. Because it is just a hugely powerful sort of thing. Okay, now only 31% said that there was hell, if it existed at all, if it were an actual location, would be a place of physical torment. That's a major shift that's taken place in our society. And we have to ask the question, why? Why if we were to hear Pastor Storno talk today, why if some of these other older traditional ideas have sort of faded, you know, why should that be the case? Certainly one has been, I think, a positive move in this way, and that there is far more interest now in putting love on, I mean, putting emphasis and priorities on loving one's neighbor, on being good stewards, on responding in a sense positively and constructively to what God offers, rather than simply try to take a negative position and say that the most important thing in the world, obviously, is to avoid some sort of final destination, which we, you know, which we call hell. What has clearly also happened is that people have come to the conclusion over the years that heaven really is a place where people who have led good lives will be rewarded. That has remained constant over the years, 71-72% on this. Okay, 54%, this is in the Harris Poll, 54% said they would be in heaven, when they were in heaven, they would be in the presence of God and Jesus. But this was not just some sort of abstract place, but there would be they would be in the presence of Jesus or God. Interesting point, only 19% said that in heaven we'll have some responsibilities. We'll have something really that we're responsible to do. Only 19%. And these are not on the polls that you have there. What you have there is unmaterial that I wanted you to see. Okay. And less than half assumed that they would see family or friends in heaven. That's one we could certainly talk about at some length. I know myself, this is a tough call. I have an aunt, I haven't used it in this class here, I did it last week. This story, I have an aunt, and World War II comes, and you know, it's difficult. Because suddenly the government comes and takes your son and sends him over to Europe, and he gets killed. And you know, what's going on here? And the way Aunt Lena had it, it was her son Harlan. He was killed as a B-25 pilot flying over over Anzio Beach and all the rest. The way she put it was, and she was one of his in the home. She had his picture and then his medals and, you know, all these things there and everything else. But the way she could cope with losing Harlan, you know, this strange thing, somebody coming and taking your boy away, and then sending him back, you know, they had done all these things. The way she could cope with it, I'll meet him in heaven. That was the way Aunt Lena came to terms with that. Or, and very, very rewarding sort of thing for her. How else could she, you know, understand this? Because she had, well, I could go on wrong, but you get the idea here. Only 5% thought that heaven would be boring. I thought that's an interesting little sidelight on this. Because some people have said, well, why aren't you interested in heaven? They said, all I do is sing and praise, and, you know, what's the big deal? We need something a little bit more than meeting that. We need, you know, pro football or, you know, or something like that to keep us going. Okay. Now, let me shift with that idea in mind. Any comments so far? What I'm trying to do is talk about some of these things. Okay. Let me recommend a book which I have on the board here, Peter Kreeft. And it's a corny title. I guess that dates me when I use the word corny. But anyway, it's a silly title. Everything you wanted to know about heaven, we're afraid to ask. But anyway, Peter Kreeft, K-R-E-E-F-T, has a book on everything you wanted to know about heaven. And he has some ideas there that sort of get us into the more specific, meaty, theological themes that we really want to be talking about. Okay. He said this in interpreting this, and as I say, there's an enormously wide variety of opinion on this. Heaven is the reason that God banged out the Big Bang, you know, the creation of the universe 18 billion years ago. Heaven is the reason that God banged out the Big Bang. This was, you know, from the very beginning, what God had in mind. And he said this, next to the idea of God, the idea of heaven is the greatest idea that has ever entered into human, you know, into human consciousness. We simply can't imagine, you know, life without some sort of idea of heaven or reward or afterlife after this life. Okay. Some of you might know the Catholic writer, Father Andrew Greeley, and he has an interesting sort of comment on this. Father Greeley says that we were born with two incurable diseases. The way he likes to put it with his exaggeration sometimes, we were born with two incurable diseases. First disease that was incurable is that we all want to live. And he calls this a disease in his metaphorical kind of, we all want to live. And that's an incurable disease. Since we can't do that, he said the second incurable disease was hope. Hope that there will be life past the life which we find ending here. That the life that we have here, which is an incurable disease, simply won't end at this point. And he said that's simply built into human nature. I suppose in Catholic, this would be sort of Catholic natural law, I suppose, if you want to get into some of the fine points on this. Okay. Traditionally, heaven has been seen, I think, as a destination and as a reward, as a relief from earthly trials. You know, I'm but a pilgrim here, heaven is my home. And if you listen carefully to a rich source of teachings about heaven, it would be the Gospels from the slaves before the Civil War. The way in which they could come to terms with having to be slaves, imagine having no hope, no matter how hard you worked, no matter how hard you did anything, you would always be a slave. You would always be there. So they would write these marvelous gospel hymns based on Old Testament and New Testament themes, expressing the idea that we are suffering here, pain, all these things here, but that heaven is our destination and that eventually we would be there. That's the way they came to cope with the difficulties, the desperation of the lives in which they found themselves. Okay. Heaven is seen, in Christian teaching here as a destination, as a reward, as a relief, as I say, from earthly trials. For some, it's seen as a reunion with loved ones. Billy Graham, I'll call him a little bit later, also has the idea we'll know each other in heaven. That's certainly, it comes from a good source. I mean, it isn't, just from anybody. Billy Graham really teaches it. He has a sermon or two he gives every year on heaven. And mentions this, as you'll see later on, he's changed some of his ideas about heaven, especially about how long it would be, how wide it would be, and everything else. But he'll be driving gold Cadillacs there. He really said this once, but then he's changed his mind and said so. But anyway, he says that we will know people that we knew here. Heaven is our real home, our permanent address, our true country. Other names that have been given for this is the New Jerusalem, Paradise Regained, if you know John Milton, the Community of Saints, the Eternal Eucharist, an end to death and sin, and the eternal ever-growing experience, of the Holy God. Okay, those are some of the terms we use because it is such a huge mind-blowing kind of a thing to try to hold on to, that we can only use words, in partial sense to try to capture these things. Okay, but what's happened in the last, 20, 30 years, and Mark, if you want to, talk about this too, because I know you're a religion watcher, and so on, I had him in class when there was 1973 is when you graduated? Yeah, right, and so on, and but you have to say, you haven't heard the jokes. The jokes had been changed. St. Olaf gives sabbaticals, so teachers will get new jokes. That's why we have sabbatical leave. So anyway, I was told that once. Oh, I haven't told you that story, right? About new stories and jokes. I do elder hostels, and I'm very happy to do them. And I wasn't scheduled 1 year to do elder hostels at St. Olaf, but what happened was that one of my friends was scheduled, and the elder hostel thing, you come in and you register on Sunday and then you start in on Monday for 5 days of class and all the rest of these things. Okay. So anyway, Sunday night before it was to start, my good friend Bob Nichols got a call. His mother was desperately ill and he had to fly out. Bob simply had to leave. No doubt about that. So the next morning at 8 o'clock, elder hostel office calls me and said, Bob had to leave. What can we do? And I said, I've got my notes from last year. And I said, how soon can I be there? How soon should I be there? And they said, a half an hour. And in Northfield, no place is very far from any other place. That's one of the advantages we had there. So I came and I walked in, and here were two people who had been in my class the year before. we saw that this was a calculated risk we had to take. And I came in, and obviously I was under some duress with this, and I said, I didn't have a chance to work up anything. Your speaker had to leave for a medical emergency, and I see people have heard me before, and they saw my consternation. And I said, you've heard me before, and they looked at me, and they were trying to make me feel better, and they said, that's all right, we can't remember what you said anyway.
Yeah.
something that, you know, they would have forgotten, but anyway. The best jokes are the true ones that happen from real life. That's always the ones that are the best jokes. And so anyway, what I was told by some people is if I want to keep teaching the other hostels, I have to get new jokes. I was told this quite seriously, and I think that's quite right. Okay. Anyway, I got to go off on a merry heart and telling jokes and everything. But what's happened in the last 23 years is to rewind now that I got off with when I'm looking at Mark there on these things is it seems as though talk about heaven, to use the military phrase here, is sort of AWOL, or absent without leave, if you want to put it that way. We really don't hear much, you know, about all these things anymore. I know myself, I've been looking for this, and I very rarely do you find anything from the pulpits, from the books and all the rest, to match what we've been getting in recent years. And it's also true in what we would call popular culture. You don't hear very much about this. Every so often, Hollywood tries to crank out a book on exorcism or something, or a movie, I should say, on exorcism or something, on all this. The one exception to this, and I was building up to this because I want to recommend it, is the TV program on Sunday night, Touched by an Angel. I watched it, and I like to consider myself pretty much a hard-boiled intellectual, and I'm a little worried about some of the sentimental stuff and everything, but it's a very good program, and I watch it with great interest, and always about one reason I think it is so popular, it's non-denominational, for one thing. And it tries to find the things that are common themes on which we can all agree, on common problems, which we'd always agree. Then if you watch for it, and I think I found it, I've watched about 6 or 7 shows, about 40 minutes into the program, then the message comes. And it's always a good message that comes in Delavise. And I would recommend this, and at first I thought this is silly, and it's, you know, it's just more stuff, but that's how they would be going next year. But they put it after their biggest, you know, CBS has put it after their most watched show, of course, 60 Minutes, and so there's always a lead in there. And so anyway, with that exception, we really don't have much talk really about heaven and hell any longer. The only thing we can agree on now is, Marty says, that we know now where, you know, the geography of heaven isn't located, and we know that when we used to hear about how hell was and the furnaces and all the rest of things, that isn't basically true. But now, as some observers have said, the only time we hear about heaven is at funerals. It isn't really talked about much more. Now, of course, lots of questions here and some explanations. Few pastors feel, some pastors feel they will encounter simply a wall of skepticism if they preach about heaven, the way that Reverend Stormo preached about it, when I was growing up. A wall of skepticism for the audiences. Some people think it's too controversial. Some people simply don't believe it. Even though there is a lot of interest in what we would call spiritual experiences, out-of-body experiences, what they call OTE, or out-of-body experience, OBE, these things, a lot of near-death experiences, that's possible, very, very popular. Was it Kubler-Ross, is that her name, Dr. Kubler-Ross? Yeah. This is the angels, remember, what was it, 3-4 years ago? We got the big thing about angels, and I think it's still popular, only that sort of Madison Avenue and Hollywood is sort of giving up on it. And everything else, but not much. With all the interest in angels, as somebody pointed out, nobody seems interested in where angels came from, where they're going. Okay, it's possible, as some observers have said, that heaven is the victim of its own hype. So much has been claimed for it that in our literal-minded age, and I think this is true, that's a very literal-minded age, very skeptical kind of age, that. We have overloaded heaven, and some people have overpromised, so to speak, and some people sort of have given up. And I think that helps explain some of this. Any of your ideas on why we don't, Luther? I don't want to pick on you, but have you preached on heaven? In the last 10, 20 years?
I think I have, but not very often.
Do you find people wanting to talk about it? Either in counseling or in small groups or.
Some. Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Any other?
Well, in our church, we have a fellow that had a near-death experience, and mm-hmm. I sit and talk to him, and the peace he felt and so forth, and he had a motorcycle accident, mm-hmm. and it changed his life. Mm-hmm. Very devout Christian, though, very much a believer.
Near-death experience?
Meaning the out-of-body, that he saw the light.
Oh, he did, the whole thing.
The whole thing. You know, you read about this in books. And I guess what you're saying, I want to contradict a little bit, because I've read some on this because of him, too. But and I think he's affected our pastor, too, to some extent, about miracles and angels and so forth, too. That just this peace that's there, the extreme peace that... And it was told that it wasn't his time, he needed to go back.
It's like we have in our liturgy a foretaste of the feast to come.
Yeah.
That's a great line.
You know, it's something that he wasn't making it up, if you know the guy.
Now, the only thing I think with, you know, with near-death experiences is I'm glad they didn't happen to me, because maybe it wouldn't be so near. Because some of you know my little wrist story and everything else.
I think I have visited Pentecostal churches with friends, and it's very definitely preached there. But in our own church, our women's Bible study, it comes up many times.
It does.
And every woman there has a different concept of what heaven is like. And we've decided it's one of God's mysteries. We don't have to know.
We don't have, that's true. I don't think there's any question that you don't have to. You know, it isn't there. It, you know, the old joke that St. Peter is going to have, you know, a clipboard with questions on it for an entrance exam before you get in. And if you don't get 75% or something else, I've got, you know, you won't be on. But I'm glad to hear that. And this is, as I say, field testing. I'm trying to find out.
Yeah, there's a story, of course, about the young woman that was preparing to get married, and she said that said to her mother, she said, "We have one problem. My husband-to-be doesn't believe in hell." And her mother said, "Well, go ahead and marry him, and we'll convince him otherwise."
You know, along this way, too, there's another book by Mark Twain, Captain Storm Cloud Goes to Heaven. Have you ever read that little tiny thing? And he is doing a spoof, but the fellow dies, and he goes off, and he comes to the first gates, and there's several heads to this person. They said, told him he's at the wrong gate, and he moves on to different gates and finally gets to the right gate to get in, and then he wants his halo and his wings, and he carries them along for a while and finds they're really too heavy, and he sees them off in ditches here and there. But he talks through this of this, you know, and wanting to see St. Peter right now, and St. Peter's busy, and this, that we make up things in our head. And I haven't got it figured out what heaven's like, but he does in his own cynicism kind of waken us up to, you know, we have this image, as kids at least, of heaven.
That reminded me one more. Father Greeley tells the story. He's got a wonderful piece on why Catholics stay within the faith given all the problems they have. And it's the basic, you know, the story for all the jokes about, say, you know, the pearly gates and St. Peter and all of that. And one day Jesus came down and was talking to St. Peter, because Jesus was very upset because a certain person had gotten into heaven whom Jesus said had no business being there, and wanted to know exactly why. And St. Peter had to look through his files, and they talked back and forth and back and forth, and I can't remember all the details. And finally St. Peter said, yes, there was some question about whether or not this person should be in heaven, but you know what happened? He said, the pebble applied, and I turned him down, but he went around to the back door, and your mother let him in. Speaking of Mary this week, your mother let him in. The mothers were more open to things like that. That would be a good one to take in Bible studies, right?
Okay. Genesis 1, Genesis 2 talks about creation. Mm-hmm. This is the recorded history. But it also talks about heaven and hell, and the devil was angels. So that preceded Genesis 1 and 2. And there's really speculation about what happened in unrecorded history, how the devil and his angels got there, whether it was prehistoric man or stuff that we see in a geology that's shaping up right now.
Well, you've got Mark, who's doing Old Testament this week, and you've got Edlin, who is a geologist next door, so I'm going to pass the buck on him. I wouldn't, my own point is I wouldn't use Genesis as literal geological history. I really don't think there's any way, because, you know, there's at least two or three creation stories there. Which one is, you know, the real one? That would be my way of putting it. And I think that's a real benefit to not see it, you know, in that particular respect. Okay, any comments? These are good. I enjoy this very much. Okay. So what can we say here by way of a brief summary of what the Bible says about heaven and hell? I think this, some things, some of this may be review for some of you, but then as I found, you know, in teaching, you can never have too much review. I think that's all this, there's another teacher back there, two teachers here I see, never have too much review. I didn't want to learn that. I thought, you know, that Mike is like my two friends who didn't remember what I said. I also thought once I said it was so great, you know, compelling and everything else, it would be forever etched on my memory, you know. Okay, anyway, moving right ahead here. Jesus taught that heavenly happiness consisted obviously not of material pleasures or of what they call Old Testament or sort of tribal triumphs, to use that expression, but of a glorious personal transformation, really of the flesh and of eternal communion, you know, with the living God. It was not only a reward, it was the believer's true, you know, the believer's true destiny. I'm but a pilgrim here, heaven is my home. The only trouble with that one was, I remember we used to have Lutheran vests, not people, we'd have a Lutheran program every 7:15 in the morning. Roy Gregerson, was that his name?
Harry
Gregerson, Harry, right. Harrison. And it would open up with the idea being that this isn't home and only heaven is home, and that didn't really sort of put a bounce into my step or anything else like that, that I'm only temporarily here for a while. I'd like to sort of get on with some of the other things. But anyway, the believer's true destiny, the ultimate home. Jesus said, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And heaven also, Jesus used, you know, several different metaphors for this. Heaven was, in his metaphors, heaven was a treasure hidden in a field. It was a pearl of great price. It was not a location on what we would call geography. And regarding heaven's actual mysteries, he told the apostles that it was not given for most people to know him. In John, in the book of John, for instance, Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven as being a place for an eternal reward, with many dwelling places. This was one of the most famous passages, of course, of all. On this, I prepare a place for you, and if I go to prepare a place for you, in other words, it was somewhere other than, you know, right here and now. On this, if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Wherever that might be, it was union with Jesus. I think that was the point. It was this good dualistic kingdom idea. The kingdom of God is now and it's here to come. Some people have real trouble with that, but, you know, there's so much what we call dualism in Lutheran teachings that's no problem. You have, you know, left hand, right hand, you have law and gospel, you have all sorts of, you know, two emphases at the same time. The kingdom of now, the kingdom is now, and the kingdom is yet to come. I think that's true. Another one I like, some of you might like to draw on, some of you might know him, he's a pastor in Chicago, Dr. Tom Streeter. Does anyone know anybody with Dr. Tom? He writes a lot for Lutheran Women Today, and he does usually the Bible study there, and it's good stuff. Tom has his doctorate from our Lutheran seminary in Chicago, and very conscientious Bible study person, and it also helps that his wife's an editor for Lutheran Women Today. But anyway, Tom says this. When examining the scriptures and everything, when we talk about heaven and hell, we are talking about our relationship with God, you know, that starts now. That's here and now, right at this point, and not necessarily sort of delayed or put it on hold or the back burner or, you know, whatever metaphor you want to use, but it's our relationship with God that begins now. He says this, as a human being, and then he uses that the word soul to be a human being also. I am either in a loving relationship with God or I am not. If there's one of the either or things there. I'm either in a loving relationship or I am not. Either God is my enemy, and that's what he calls as hell. I think that's a good definition of hell. God is my enemy. That's there. Either God is my enemy or God is my parent and friend. And I like the idea very much of God as parent. I mean, I don't mind talking about this a little bit. I went through St. Olaf, and it was a lot different than it is now, and I hit that godless state university, you know, on top of Bascom Hill, known as University of Wisconsin. And I really wasn't ready for, you know, a lot of the stuff that went on there, and especially my field was American history. And intellectually speaking, our American history department was famous then for being the center of intellectual Marxism in this country. Not a whole lot of evangelical testifying and witnessing going on top of the Bascom Hill, if you know, Madison. I wasn't ready at all for the challenges, you know, that I found there, because it was, some of this other stuff was very persuasive and friendly, and I mean, it was very friendly, very attractive for me, and I really, the only word for it, I lost the faith was for some time, rather significantly. And it wasn't until I came back as a parent that I understood what God was like. Understanding what God is and how I can respond to God as a parent is the clearest way I have. All the other things I find great. Sermons are wonderful. The hymns, the art, you know, the music, all these things are very important. But it was, you know, the experiences I had as a parent. And I didn't have a born-again conversion experience, but I had something close to it. Both the children, I had a boy and a girl, they both went here to meet children and very influenced by this place. But anyway, they were both still in diapers, and it was flu time. And when you say in Minnesota, when is it flu time? I think that's true. It's going on most of the time. But anyway, it was flu time, and it was 4 a.m. We had run out of diapers. My wife was having a situation with flu where it was coming out, you know, in all places that it could come out, and all the rest. And I simply had to sit down. It's up to me. I mean, it wasn't any desperate. We didn't have to call 911, or we didn't even have 911 on those days. But anyway, we didn't have to call anything like 911. But the responsibility was there, and it was up to me, obviously, to do something at 4 a.m, and I was able to cope. My role as a parent became extremely clear. I had 3 people dependent on me. That's what I'm trying to say. I had 3 people dependent on me, and they were dependent on me only because they couldn't do it, you know, for themselves. That was what I'm trying to say. Helen wasn't, you know, very seriously ill. She recovered like we all do from that thing, and the kids obviously were very dependent on all of this. But at that particular point, I saw my role as a parent, and I didn't have to have a whole lot of answers that I thought I needed before. But I acknowledged the fact that they were dependent on me. That's what I'm trying to say. That didn't exalt me or make me feel, you know, powerful or anything else like that. But if I hadn't been there, and this could have happened to anybody, if I hadn't been there, obviously, who knows what might have happened. But the strength, the ways to cope with that problem were there. I didn't have to, you know, to make anything up like that. So it came back very clearly as, you know, as God is parent. And then when you raise them, it becomes very clear how important, you know, the role of parent is. Like, there'd be all the other things, but anyway, that's what I wanted to say. So anyway, back to the idea here of heaven. The word heaven is shorthand for Jesus' proclamation of the kingdom of heaven. This is what Thomas said. And the gospel says, you know, the gospels, Jesus says he is ushering in the kingdom of heaven now in his person. And that person and that kingdom will be fully realized when all the powers of evil are defeated. And God alone rules at the fulfillment of what God started. This is not to minimize, obviously, all the crises and the conflicts and the evils and all the rest that are going on in the world. No, because what I was trying to say at that forum the other night was that how do you explain all the great disasters and evils and things that are going on in the world today? Except for the fact that there still is some, if you want, whatever you want to call it, some sort of demonic force at work taking place, and that obviously there will have to be some kind of time in which this is turned around. Okay, so heaven, what Tom says, to come back to his point, is that heaven begins now for those who embrace, you know, this relationship with God. And then that's the great verses. So if anyone is in Christ, there is a new creation. Everything old has passed away and everything has become new. In other words, heaven is the relationship I have with God because of Christ now. That's the point. Not only in the hereafter. That's what I'm trying to say. But it becomes, the new creation happens here and now. That's Lutheran dualism. But I think that's what I want to say. Okay. So another question that comes up with that is, what happens then between, you know, the death of the body and resurrection? This is always a very tough one. What happens on this? And again, there's no consensus on this one, but this is, you know, what I would say. Actually, Scripture, for one thing, is for one point here, is rather vague on this point. The New Testament sort of calls it sleeping or being with Christ. We die in hope not because we have some sort of immortal soul, but because we know we're in the hands, you know, of a loving parent who will awaken us, who will awaken us in the resurrection. That'd be my idea, that we are as asleep. And then there will come the resurrection, because if we were Christ now, we wouldn't need a resurrection, because we'd already be there. If, you know, if there's some people say there'll be, you know, there'll be heaven instantly, you know, at death, at the passing, as my wife likes to say, as we go away from this world to another world. I think that's a nice way to put it.
But how does that fit this near-death experience? the seeing of the light, of seeing, and in hearing this, that you must go back, or and feeling the love and the peace. I know that's where I get mixed up, because I haven't been taught by Aki Rolander, if you know him, in our Redeemer's Lutheran Church very much, that this is a time of sleep, but this crosses my wires.
Welcome to the club.
Saying more that, you know, it's a, mm-hmm. a passing.
Tough to do research, as I say, it's tough to, I'm not trying to be silly on this, but it's tough to do research on this one. You have to respect the validity of these experiences. I don't think there's any question.
People
these
are
people
changed.
Aren't out to make money or
no,
to deceive
not
us
this film.
Or anything else like that.
What's the basic Lutheran doctrine or?
And we are asleep.
That we are asleep?
We are, there will be a resurrection, and that's when the final.
But most people, lay people go the other way, don't they? We're going to be in heaven when we die. Just a common.
What about today? You will be with me in paradise.
Today.
Yeah.
I've thought of that one a lot.
I'd like to know.
Yeah.
I understand it better.
But then you can throw into the. But the fact that this is Christ, this is God speaking, and a day is the same as 1,000 years.
Yeah.
So then today could be 1,000 years.
Yeah. 1,000 is 1,000 years in my sight. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah. So.
Now
the monkey wrench into the works.
Any others? Yes.
Perhaps we are bound by time, but perhaps heaven is not, and so it may be a question we can't. Even asked. I mean,
but still, this fellow in real time, because he's walking around our church right now, had his experience where he saw the light, he heard a voice,
right.
He was told to go
but
back.
But he wasn't all the way across either.
Yeah. Well, no, yeah. No, but yeah, there's some books have been written, and it isn't just one or two, but many. It's tough. You know, I know there's peace there at least.
Well, I'm not going to do much more personal research on the subject. read what Russell and the others say, and that'll be my own thing. But I like the idea about time. But it's a whole different thing all together. God doesn't see this as 1977, the next is 1997, and all the rest of these things. But the 1,000 years are today. What you know. How literal can you be with these things? And of course, you could also argue that if, you know, that was on the cross on Good Friday. Well, Jesus wasn't in paradise on Good Friday. Jesus was in the lower depths on Good Friday.
Okay.
If you want to argue literally, that's what I'm trying to say. That's what's wrong with literal argumentation. See, Jesus wasn't in paradise on Good Friday.
Nor the day after.
I'm sorry? Or the day after. Right. And then if you really want to get a literal, we say he was, 3 days, but it really wasn't 72 hours. You know, from the time, let's say he died, what is it, about noon, is it, on Good Friday, they say, about when the heavens rent and everything else. Well, you know, it isn't 72 hours until daylight on Easter Sunday. But we all see he rose again in 3 days, but it's not 3 days. You see how you play these games, and I think you're just spinning your wheels, with that sort of thing. Sure.
I think that we try to come up with answers with things that the Lord doesn't necessarily want us to have answers to.
And we don't need to.
We don't need them either.
Right.
Yeah.
And
faith.
Yeah.
Because what is it? I like the verse, we walk by faith, not by light.
Amen.
Yeah. I think that's one. And, I've dealt enough with the intellectual stuff, and I'm dedicated to teaching and my writing and all the rest of these things. We have to absorb everything we can there and learn from others, but there comes a time when there's a leap. This is what I was trying to say in that thing on the historic Jesus. It's the same kind of thing here. You get the idea. All right. A couple words about hell. We aren't all that sure, obviously, what has happened, and the basic teachings from about hell have come not really from the Bible, but how people have interpreted the Bible, over a long period of time. In the Old Testament, there's the word which you see there, S-H-E-O-L, which doesn't suggest punishment, but sleep or a dreamlike state. That's there. And then we have what we call the intertestament period. And that's where the idea of hell comes in a little more clearly. The word here is G-E-H-E-E-N-A. And I always like this one, when they were trying to think of the worst possible place hell could be, or punishment could be, it was the dump outside of Jerusalem. You know, it was simply stagnating. I mean, they didn't have waste management or BFI or anything else like that to take care of the problems that we had there. I have to throw in a word from the waste management, because the man who just gave $28 million to my college is the president of waste management. He would have tidied up the Jerusalem dump. Dean Bundrock, absolutely, okay. A place of filth and stench that constantly smolder. And that's how the word about the trying to use metaphors, you know, that people could understand. This is where we get our apocalyptic idea about, you know, on these things. Okay. But I think basically the way I would understand it is hell is the ultimate manifestation, you know, of God's wrath. That life without God, and we are left to our own devices. That's the way I would like to put it. We're left to our own devices. Can't, you know, anything worse than being left to our own devices. Or, you know, that's what I was saying. Hell is to experience God's wrath. But then, as we know, Christ has conquered sin and death, and that sets us free. That's heaven, whatever that might be, in terms of geography. Okay. And that this is the what we're going to have. You know, that raises the question, do we become believers, you know, as some people say, simply because we are so frightened by the idea of hell, that it's a negative response? Or I would say that may well have been the case for some people. What's that old, that bumper sticker that we used to have for a while? Read the Bible, it'll scare the hell out of you. that's one, but I don't know. Who knows? Let's go back to the New Testament on this. The only place where there is a long description in the New Testament about heaven, of course, would be in the book of Revelation. And I think everybody is agreed here, with maybe a few literalists along the way, that is pretty much, you know, a book of symbols and of mystery. We have it over in the bookstore. And I heard the lectures when they were given here. Dan Erlander, maybe some of you know him in the Seattle area, has he did a Bible study on the book of Revelation. This is when this was big stuff. Remember, what's his name? Hal Lindsey was writing The Late Great Planet Earth, and he sold 18, you know, people say, I'm just jealous when I use the statistic, because I'm a writer too, but he sold 18 million copies, you know, in the 1970s, and even outsold cookbooks, he even outsold sex manuals in the lead book, and everything else. And so a lot of people were getting some rather strange ideas about, you know, the end times. And they would look to the book of Revelation, and we have a copy, we have books for sale in the bookstore here, Dan Erlander's on this. And if you know Dan, he always has the light touch, and he does it very, very well. And he has the light touch, and he uses the symbol of the Lamb, you know, for the book of Revelation. And I would certainly recommend that strongly, because otherwise the book of Revelation, I remember what my professor, Cliff Nelson, said, it's the happy hunting ground for all kinds of weird, odd, screwy, you know, off-the-wall kinds of interpretations. The seals, you know, David Koresh down in Waco was opening a new seal all the time, and, you know, looking for, you know, where that led, all kinds of difficulties on this. So anyway, over the centuries, you know, interpretations of heaven have changed a lot. I saw people moving out there, but it's not time yet. Okay, here's the stuff I promised you about Billy Graham. And he has repented from this, and I really respect this. He made some statements, and he knows when to say he's wrong. And that some people can't do that. But Graham has learned to do that, and I really respect that. You know, just for instance, he didn't realize for a while he was being used politically by Richard Nixon. In the 1974 rally that they had in wasn't it Nashville or Knoxville, and everything else, and suddenly, you know, the Watergate tapes came. And he heard a part of Richard Nixon that he didn't hear when they were having prayer meetings together, you know, up in the Oval. Okay, anyway, Billy Graham in 1950 said, heaven was a place as real as Los Angeles, London, Algiers, or Boston. 1,600 miles long, 1,600 miles wide, and 1,600 miles, you know, high. Once there, Christians were going to sit around the fireplace and have parties, and angels will wait on us, and we will drive down the golden streets in yellow Cadillac convertibles. And we can find that sermon and can say that. So Graham has grown up. I have to tell my Billy Graham story. This is the way it fits here. In college, he had become, he was in college in 1948-49, he had just become very popular. William Randolph Hearst and Henry with the papers and Henry Luther with Life magazine gave him, you know, all kinds of publicity, and he became instantly popular. He came to Minneapolis in 1949 for a revival up at the old convention center that was there on 11th Street. If that, some of you might have some nostalgia about that. Well, anyway, there was this one girl, Donna Simonson, and I, she knows I tell this story, and that's fine. We were interested, and she came from a more Baptist, a more evangelical sort of background than I did from my Kenyan sources, but I wanted to see him, and so on, and in fact, later on, we met later on, she thought maybe that was her taking me to this Billy Graham revival, the thing that started my interest in American religious life, and it could well be. Well, anyway, we went, and there was Cliff Barrels, you know, leading the Union Choir with his trombone. Remember, he always used to lead with the trombone, and George Beverly Shea was singing How Great Thou Art. We put that into our LBW. We noticed that that was quite a change for some hymnologists and things. But anyway, it was the year, you know, the Billy Graham format that he's used, and I respect this enormously, all these years. He hasn't changed. He doesn't have a jazzy new hymn. He still sings Just As I Am. Some of the old hymns, and that was the title of his autobiography that has just come out too, which is good reading. And it's Just As I Am, and you'll take a current problem like, you know, like the Cold War or whatever it might be, and then he'll preach on that, and then he'll give some biblical things, and then he'll have the movement towards conversion, towards the altar call, the born again experience, you know, from the story with Nicodemus. Okay. Well, anyway, they came, and, you know, every eye bowed, and then they called for this, you know, don't, your friends will wait, and all these things. And he had the altar call. And we were sitting there, and all of a sudden I felt a little nudge, you know, in my side. And the clear message was from Donna Mae that I was supposed to go forward. And I sort of sat there in my Norwegian Lutheran, didn't move. And then about 20 seconds later, a pretty good nudge came in. And Graham was still calling, and the counselors were, you know, going up and down the aisles for people in distress and signals like that. And finally, after about a minute, the choir was still singing and all the rest of it came real whack, right there. And I had to draw on all my old resources and my catechism and all the rest of these things, and I didn't go forward. And that was the end of Roland and Donna Mae. From that point, because we divided over that. But anyway, moving right ahead here. I would recommend clearly, you know, the book here that I have called on the board. It's wonderful. And it's interesting, you know, he draws on a lot of different sources. It came up in the other day, too. I was lucky enough, when it was a 2-3 years ago, over in San Diego, they were building a new Mormon temple. And the Mormons have always been very sensitive to the idea that nobody except Mormons could get into the temple, okay? So they were building a new one, and what the Mormons did, and more to their credit and all the rest, they had it for 30 days, they had open house when it was ready, and they would have tours through the new temple so everybody could see what was there. There weren't any secret rites or no bloodletting or anything else like this, and so on, and we went through this. We got a little bitch, it wasn't too bad, you know, about Joseph Smith and prophecy and all these things, but we went through there. And then at the climax was the highest room, and that was sort of their physical version of what heaven was. I thought it'd be interesting to see how hard people try to portray in this life with painting and a sculpture and carpeting and lighting and all these things, what heaven was. And it was white. And a very high ceiling, and there were high crystals, and the plush carpeting and all the rest. And this was the place to which people could ascend, you know, for the time in which they had the thoughts, and the idea was to lead their thoughts towards some sort of heavenly destination, much like this. And, you know, you could sit around and being sarcastic and cynical and all the rest, and poke fun at some of this stuff, but basically I was impressed with the thrust of what they were trying to do with this as a portrayal, because it indicated to me how meager and limited our minds are when it comes to something, you know, as powerful and as overwhelming as all this is. Okay. What I like is what Marty says about this. He said, we can negotiate, this will be my conclusion here, we can negotiate everything about heaven, including about some certain parts of heaven. We can negotiate everything about the paving of heaven, the mapping of heaven, and the furniture of heaven. That, you know, the Mormons are trying to have some sort of paving and mapping and furniture of heaven. And we can negotiate. That doesn't have to be what we have. If we were to have a temple like they would, we wouldn't maybe have the same kind of furniture. And this is what Marty says, I don't know of a church, even a conservative one, where I could get run out of for saying that the language about the pearly gates and the golden streets, all this is symbolic. Everybody agrees today that the pearly gates, the golden streets language is symbolic. He said he wouldn't be run out if he preached that in a church. But I would get run out of churches if I were to say that there wasn't an end to the life hereafter, that our life here, as we know it here now, does end, and that it won't be the same life in the next world. That's what he's trying to say. That there is dust to dust and ashes to ashes, that the world that is to come is a world that is totally different from this one. It won't be just sort of, you know, put a tire pump in and, you know, get you started all over again and all that sort of thing. All right. There is an end to this world. When he says this, and I like this line, the physicality of heaven is in trouble. That's a lot of people are wondering about the old ideas about the pearly gates and all this sort of thing. The physicality of heaven is in trouble, but not that to which it points. And I like that, but not that to which it points. Heaven is the idea, the goal, the destination to which we point is not in trouble. A lot of people, you know, as I say, you know, this thing about reinventing the faith, say that, well, in the light of this and the light of that and all the rest of things, we have to reinvent. And what Marty says is, well, what we can do is imagine heaven not as a physical location, not as we had been taught by Reverend Stormo and some of the other ones before, but maybe something in between. Something between the old idea of it being, you know, the old way, or the idea that there's no heaven at all. And I like, he says, we can think of heaven as an alternative state, and probably, in the way I like to look at it, as another dimension. I really think that maybe the best way to look at it is that we don't understand there's another dimension altogether out there that we're not aware of. I think that's a totally different, instead of, you know, just the three dimensions that we have now. There may be a totally different dimension. Who's to say that the three dimensions that we have are now are all there is? This is why I like things about the Hubble telescope, for instance. They're finding that the universe, I've said this before here, they're finding that the universe is still expanding. It's not all fixed and set, and there's things going on. It's a self-generating kind of thing that are going on all the time. Maybe, I don't think Hubble is not going to find heaven. That's the point some people are sending up there and all this, but it's going to find, you know, that we're involved is a tiny dot, and this is, you know, I feel so strong, tiny dot in this incredible universe, and to think that right here now is all there is. I think, you know, just simply misguided. Or if you look at it from the cynical side, there is that marvelously cynical song by Peggy Lee. Oh, what is it, 25, 30 years ago? If that's all there is. If that's all there is, remember her conclusion, if that's all there is, then bring on the blues and let's start dancing. Right. And I think, obviously, there's more to it than that. Okay.
Have you ever dealt with a situation where a couple, each with their past their middle years always, and each have a disease or problems that will end their life in death very not too far off, and they decide to take their own life, leaving everything to their children, their neighbors, their friends, and settling all their financial situations, and leaving a good spirit for them. Mm-hmm. Well, how does that fit in this whole thing?
Well, that would be one individual. One of my brother knew he was terminal with cancer, and what he did was he found a line from Pope John 23, who was one of the great people of our time, Mother Teresa was thinking about now. And Pope John said, my bags are packed. I like that one. My bags are packed. He knew where he was going. He didn't know where the depot would be, but he was there. We have this assurance. That's what I'm trying to say. We also have the assurance that lunch is in 10 minutes. So, and that this place doesn't really, folks, that bus keeps coming in and out. And you might be on my agenda, but we can follow already. here that keeps things going in this place is the bus station. So we're going to live up to it. Okay.
Thank you.